This is the Sports Illustrated Boxing Podcast.
It's boxing.
A look inside boxing with Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix. Interviews, analysis, and everything going on in boxing. And now a man who I wish was called the Boston Bleeder.
All doctors to the ER.
It's sort of like getting punched in the face.
Chris Mannix.
All right, Ed Rutkowski is in, former HBO marketing executive. His Fisciano's podcast, one of the best podcasts out there for the business of boxing. Terrific one, comes out every couple of weeks. Evan, thanks for joining me, man. Welcome back. Third appearance here on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. I'm starting to challenge Mr. Idek over there.
Nothing will keep Keith from that number one spot on the podcast. Lot to get to, Evan, when it comes to the business of boxing, and it never gets boring in this business. So I want to start with the Pacquiao fight, which we saw a couple of weeks ago. The pay-per-view numbers, at least the early reports on it, have started to come in. Mike Coppinger had it at 500,000. I've heard a little bit less, but let's say, for the sake of argument, it did come in that 425 to 500,000 range. What's your reaction to that type of number for Pacquiao's fight against Keith Thurman?
Well, I think in the overall marketplace, 500,000 pay-per-view buys is a pretty good overall number. But there's just so many more questions that come with this number. And I think a lot of it is there's just so much interesting stuff happening in the pay-per-view business right now. And the question is, like, is it real? First of all, 500, it's great that Mike came out with that. And I'm not questioning the, like, how accurate that is. He certainly lives in this space a lot more than I do in terms of just constantly being on the beat. But there's a million different indicators. And if you talk to people in the industry, a lot of different numbers come out. And I think part of the puzzle is piecing all that together. And I know Mike was working on that hard. So I'm not questioning his accuracy, but I've heard very different things. Like DirecTV certainly, did better than you'd think. The digital numbers did a lot worse than you'd think. Some of the cable companies did okay. Some of them did pretty well. Some of them didn't do great. So, it's really hard to piece it together. And I think that's why, traditionally, if there was a number that you could put a 5 or a 6 in front of, PBC probably would have put that out much earlier in the week, last week. But you're hearing this now. It really took a while to even get that kind of number. And that could, you can easily, in terms of the PR world, look at that as a success. I mean, I do question whether you're actually making money on a Pacquiao fight at that number, but I still think it's an overall good number.
You mentioned the how do you know, when do you know it? You worked at HBO for a long time. When does a network know around what that number is going to be?
Well, it used to, we're in a different universe right now. It used to be pretty easy. Like it used to be you start to see tracking on Wednesday or Thursday, and by Friday at a certain point, you can start to see enough evidence that you just plug it into a formula. And a lot of times it was done with people at DirecTV just because they had a huge percentage of the overall pay-per-view marketplace. And certainly by Friday late or by Saturday, even before the fight started, you would have a pretty accurate assessment of what the fight was going to do. And we're just not in that world anymore. And there's a lot of different reasons for it. I mean, there's DirecTV and a lot of the cable companies have just been hemorrhaging subscribers, basically. And that's a huge part of it. So you have to take that into account. There's the rise of essentially buying the pay-per-view on digital, which you would think on the surface, oh, that's just replacing the cable company, traditional buys. But it's actually not. It's much different because the splits are dramatically different if you buy the pay-per-view fight on digital versus if you buy it through your cable company. And the process of getting there is actually much different. If you're buying it on a digital app or, you have to enter your credit card information and there's so many extra steps where you have to actually think about, do I want to spend $75 on this? Versus, you buy it on Comcast, you hit two buttons and you've ordered the fight. It's pretty easy. But the PBC would likely get a much better split if it's bought through a digital entity. So that's if they're retaining a lot more of that money, I mean, 500,000 could actually put them in the profit. And I think what you've also seen behind the scenes is the networks have started to get involved and push to lower the splits from the cable companies. And they've aggressively pursued the strategy. I don't know this, but I believe it's because they're going to get a higher percentage take on it. And I'm guessing PBC gets a higher take on that as well. But that actually disincentivizes the cable companies to put a lot of extra resources behind their pay-per-view campaigns. And for as much hemorrhaging as the cable companies and the places like DirecTV have done in terms of overall subscribers, they still have the biggest pipeline to the likeliest candidate to buy a pay-per-view in terms of if you're profiling someone by age, income, you know, all sorts of other elements, basically. So it gets really complex.
It's interesting hearing you say at the beginning of that how the tracking numbers would be a good indicator of what the overall buy would be. Mark Taff used to have this discussion with me all the time, and I never really believed him because in every pay-per-view I've ever bought on anything, I've just kind of done it because I've been sitting there and be like, all right, well, I think I'm going to buy a pay-per-view tonight. But there really is something to be – I guess maybe there are more people that plan it than if those tracking numbers really are an indicator of what an overall buy rate's going to be.
Well, they're small overall numbers, but the percentages, you know, it's like polling in an election. Even though they're small sample sizes, if you're looking at the right sample sizes, you can model it out and have it down like pretty accurately. But yeah, I'm the same way though. I bought pay-per-views before I started working at HBO, and I, you know, in my head, I was always like, oh, there's, you know, it starts if you're on the West Coast at 6 o'clock or 9 o'clock or whatever. But I always just ordered it, you know, 2 minutes before the fight started, or sometimes halfway through the first undercard or whatever. But that's, you know, they're definitely, the model doesn't need that. It takes that into account.
No. So I know listening to your previous podcast, you were very interested to see what this number was going to be because what Fox did was a little bit different or a lot different than what an HBO or a Showtime has done. What was different about how Fox tried to build an audience, promote this pay-per-view than what an HBO or Showtime has done?
Well, Fox leveraged all their assets to get behind this pay-per-view in a way that is pretty unprecedented. And kudos to Fox for doing that. I think what happened is, you know, like I mentioned earlier, we saw some of the good and bad ramifications of that. I mean, in, you know, what I talked about is in my time at HBO, like we would have given anything to have that kind of muscle to use. I mean, Fox was doing it on the Women's World Cup game. They did it right before that game started. It, you know, they were putting it all over digitally. They were putting it all over their radio. I saw it all over, you know, FS1, you know, not only running promos for it, but just in the talk shows. I mean, it's basically just used as content. And that's really, it's both really impressive, but it comes at a cost. And the cost was they're extracting a higher percentage from the cable companies. That's why they put so many resources behind it, clearly. And it ends up being, you have to ask this question, like, what's more effective in terms of marketing a pay-per-view? Is it going into those and focusing on the right markets that matter? Because the way the cable systems break down is usually one cable system is dominant in a city. Like, you know, just to give an example, like Comcast is sort of the dominant force in Washington, D.C. and Philadelphia and Boston. And so, you know, you're trying to figure out what's more important, just having Fox on a national scale and just sort of ignoring all that stuff and disincentivizing the cable companies, or is it, you know, just that big Fox bazooka? Especially, this wasn't even done during the NFL. I mean, during the NFL, I could see, like, that's really an incredible time to use that Fox bazooka to really get behind a fight.
So, you know, Porter Garcia was a successful, or not Porter Garcia, Spence Garcia was a successful pay-per-view. Let's call this Pacquiao-Thurman fight a relatively successful pay-per-view. Do you think Fox looks at these numbers that they did on pay-per-view and the PBC looks at these numbers and says, we should be doing pay-per-views all the time? I mean, does this incentivize them to keep doing pay-per-views, what they've seen from the last two major fights?
what certainly incentivizes Fox to do it, because Fox, you know, unless the fighter has a contract directly with Fox, then, you know, Fox suffers no financial downside. I mean, their only downside is basically they're using inventory on their network that they could have otherwise sold as ads to, you know, advertisers. So they're missing out on that revenue. But if the percentage they're getting is high enough, then they're really motivated to do it. And it also, obviously, putting on these big events gives them content that they can then talk about on, you know, their shoulder programming, not necessarily just for boxing, but their talk shows, you know, all that kind of stuff. It can be really beneficial from that perspective for Fox. The PBC has to take into account whether these things actually make money. And I don't know the inside elements of the deal that the fighters got. I mean, it sounds like Spence and Garcia probably made money because they probably took lower guarantees and had upside. And so there was less risk for PBC on that one. With the Pacquiao fights, I really question whether those made money. But again, it goes back to some, you know, that sort of, it used to just be a really easy formula to, you know, when, you know, when at least 90 or 95% of the buys came through the cable sort of, you know, the cable systems to figure out whether something made money or not. Now it's just so disparate that you can't really tell, because some of the buys, the PBC is going to get a much higher percentage. Some of the buys, it's going to be lower. And, you know, some of the buys, they could have done better had they put a bigger marketing effort behind it. And, you know, it starts to get really complex, basically, to determine whether they actually made money on it or not.
You know, Bob Arum is convinced that there's no way that Pacquiao can be making money for the people that are working with him. And he's basing that off the negotiations he had with Pacquiao before Pacquiao jumped to the PBC and the declining numbers that he was doing. And you were there at HBO when he was, you know, doing those numbers, and they did kind of drop off pretty precipitously, you know, over the last couple of years. And if Pacquiao was still demanding to be paid at the level he was getting paid when he was doing a million plus pay-per-view buys, it's kind of hard to see how it's even all possible that he's that the PBC is making money off Manny Pacquiao.
Well, even if you look at the one that just happened in the old universe, 500,000 pay-per-view buys at $75 a pop. You know, you basically say the cables, all the other distributors involved are basically taking half the money, is sort of the old equation. And even that's not totally accurate, and there's a lot of other things that go into it than that. But let's just use that to make the math simple. Well, 500,000 pay-per-view buys at $75 a pop, I mean, that all of a sudden that looks like you're about $16 or $17 million in revenue from pay-per-view. Well, if Manny Pacquiao made $20 million, like, Bobby Arum's probably right. I mean, yes, there's other ways to make money. Like, there's the gate. I read that the gate was about $6 million. I don't know what percentage split PBC gets of that, but let's just say they got the whole thing. You know, if Keith Thurman made $5 million, and I don't know, I saw their reported salaries were 10 and 2.5 respectively. You know, all of a sudden, you're barely scraping by just with your main event, and that's not counting any of the other costs associated with putting on a huge event, including undercard fighter salaries, including you're paying staffs to, you know, to do all this kind of stuff. And like, there's all these other factors that go into it. I mean, Bob Arum might be right on that.
Yeah, well, I think he wants to be right, that's for sure. let's talk about the broadcast for a second. I've been, and you and I have discussed this in previous podcasts, but I think that Fox has done a very nice job with its shoulder programming. I think that how they do fights, where they go to the desk, I think Kate Abdo's become a very good interviewer at that spot. But how they are treating Terrence Crawford and how they've decided to treat the WBO is perplexing to me. And this came up during the broadcast where they flashed on the screen welterweight champions, and they put Spence up there, and they put Porter up there, and they put Thurman up there. They even put Pacquiao, who has a secondary WBA title. Pacquiao going into that Thurman fight was not, by any credible standard, a world champion. They put Pacquiao up there, but they refused to put Terrence Crawford on that list. And this is not the first time, Evan, that they have decided to kind of omit Terrence Crawford and act like he's not part of the welterweight landscape. What do you make of that decision to to act like these are the welterweights and Crawford is not a part of it?
Well, I don't understand it on several levels. I think, first of all, it's really easy to just sit there and say, oh, it's an odd time to take a stand against a sanctioning body. I mean, not that, you know, look, in some instances, I'm going to applaud taking a moral stance against a sanctioning body, obviously. But in this one, it's like, well, the WBO seems to have a lot of champs at Top Rank and none, you know, or very few with the PBC. This seems to be a little bit more of like a personal, you know, for however personal a company could be, like it's a little bit more of a personal thing with PBC and WBO. But just to omit Terrence Crawford, it is a joke. I mean, it's like everybody can see through that. And I think all you have to do is mention him. I don't understand it on that level, just sort of a journalistic integrity level. But then I don't understand it on a financial level either, because it looks like the way that this is going to shake out is the most lucrative fight you can make, and maybe depending on the pay-per-view numbers, the only pay-per-view fight you can make for Spence besides Manny Pacquiao is Terrence Crawford. And so you should want to build him up. Like, you should want to build to that. You know, there's going to come a time when the PBC is just not going to have fighters available to fight Errol Spence in a credible fight. Like, I'm one of those people. I believe Spence and Crawford are generational talents. They're levels above everybody else. And I think all it's going to take is one or two more fights from Errol Spence against PBC competition to show that. Now, look, I could be wrong, but, you should be building towards that big fight, in my opinion. ESPN should be doing it. Fox should be doing it. They should be looking to work together on it. And I don't see the downside in doing that.
I don't either. But why do you think that Fox goes along with it? I mean, I don't know how much control Fox has over those broadcasts. I mean, they're PBC broadcasts, but they're on Fox airwaves. And you would think, I mean, they're doing it right with Tyson Fury and Deontay Wilder, or presumably they're going to be doing it in the next couple of weeks. I don't really understand why that is just being allowed in the Fox universe. I mean, in football, they promote games that are on other networks. Why do you think Fox stands for that?
Honestly, I really have no idea. I mean, I think what'll end up happening is they'll put on a Spence pay-per-view. You know, it sounds like it's going to be September 28th with Porter, and you know, maybe that one does okay. Maybe Spence does a little bit better than we think. And look, hopefully for Spence, he can build a pay-per-view audience. But if he's not able to regularly go on pay-per-view, they're going to have to include Crawford. Like they're going to have to say, oh, sorry, guys. I'm guessing it was something coming from upper management in the PBC just saying, hey, look, do us, you got to respect our wishes on this. And Fox said, okay. But I don't really know. It's unlike any other sport. I mean, no one else really does this. So it's really perplexing with this one.
Yeah. I mean, I hate the phrase, the rising tides raise all ships. I hear that way too often in sports, but it's true that if you're just talking about major fights, you can kind of talk them almost into existence. And by talking about fighters on other platforms or other networks and other promotional companies, I think it's good for everybody. Now, with Pacquiao, there's the natural sense that, or the natural prediction that he could wind up fighting the winner of Spence versus Porter. I don't know if that's going to happen, Evan. I don't know that Manny Pacquiao's team is going to be rushing towards that fight. I think, especially if Spence wins, I think they'll look at a different direction. I'm not a believer that this sort of welterweight tournament they have going on over the PBC side of the street, I don't think it's going to end with Pacquiao versus the winner of that Spence-Porter fight. What do you think?
Well, some of it comes back. Look, it comes back to this financial question of, like, why do they keep putting on these Pacquiao fights if they're losing money? And look, maybe they're not losing money. I mean, you know, if Manny Pacquiao is paying 15% of his purse to PBC, maybe that's the difference between the fight making money or not making money. You know, maybe there's other margins that, you know, in this new universe that, you know, we're not aware of, and maybe they're making money on these things. But if they're not making money, the only thing I could think of is that they're building to Floyd and Manny part two. And I think, like, some of the social media stuff we saw is them jabbing at each other. And I actually think there's a great narrative now for it. Floyd's been out long enough, and I think Manny's been looking sharp. And I think you can sell that as a big fight, you know, and you can benefit from it huge in the buildup to it. I think that's what they have to be looking at. You know, if I was on Team Pacquiao, I would position myself to get that big payday because nothing else is going to come close to that. Even if it doesn't do the crazy numbers it did last time, it's the biggest fight you can make in boxing in terms of pay-per-view right now. Nothing else is even close.
Okay, so what kind of business do you think that does do? Because I'm with you. I mean, Floyd going on to Instagram and just, you know, saying, Pacquiao, keep my name out of your mouth, after he sat ringside for Pacquiao's fight and was in the ring after the fight in his, you know, nominal role as a promoter of that event. That to me suggests that there could be some momentum there. But is there really going to be that strong an interest for a 42, almost 43-year-old Mayweather and a 40, almost 41-year-old Manny Pacquiao to fight again? Because I think there'll be a lot of people out there that pan that as just a money grab. And I'll be one of them, you know, frankly, because, you know, in 2015, that fight didn't have the relevance it would have had 3 or 4 years earlier, but it was still relevant. You could still say that the winner of that fight was the king of the welterweight division. The winner of Pacquiao versus Mayweather is not the king of the welterweight division. The winner of Pacquiao versus Mayweather might not even be like top three in the welterweight division. Certainly not top two if you consider Spence and Crawford in that category. I mean, do you think that will do the kind of business that they're hoping for? And what would that business be?
Look, if you can sell Floyd Mayweather versus Conor McGregor, you can definitely sell Floyd versus Manny part two. I mean, and I think it transcends so much of that. And Fox is, or, you know, I don't even know. It might be, I think I'm really interested to see if the Showtime, how much ink do they have on Mayweather? Do they automatically have his next fight? Would this be a Fox and Showtime joint pay-per-view because of what both could offer, even if it's inside the PBC? There's so many fun questions from my end for that kind of thing. But I think this can be a very easy sell to the casual audience. I think hardcore boxing fans will absolutely agree with you. There's no question about it. And the hardcore fan of me totally agrees with you. It's not really that relevant for the sport, but I would think it's fun. I would certainly buy it. If I'm saying that, I think you'll easily, even though hardcore fans would protest, I think you'll probably eventually convince them over. And I think it's a really easy fight to convince for casuals. And I think part of that is the way you're selling it. I mean, so many people tune in to see Floyd lose. And this is really you could sell it as, hey, this is your opportunity to see Floyd lose. He hasn't really fought a relevant fight in a couple of years, and he's going to be rusty, and Pacquiao's looking great. Like, it's an easy sell.
Yeah. I guess even if it does half the business the first time around, it's still record-setting with some of the numbers that they put up in that first fight. So, I don't know. We'll see. But it does seem like, you know, the Floyd Instagram post, and look, the Pacquiao comebacks, can we just establish right now Pacquiao's not writing those posts?
Like, oh, yeah.
I don't know. I couldn't tell. Maybe Floyd dictated the Instagram post. I don't know. But I know 100% Pacquiao was not clapping back at Floyd Mayweather on Twitter. That is not happening. He's got a guy who does it. It's publicist-driven right there.
Yep. So, I think we know who's doing that, yeah.
Oh, yeah. We both know who's doing that. You mentioned Showtime, and Showtime has really kind of fallen far back in the pack when it comes to putting on significant matches. Just a handful of championship-level fights. They've done, they did the Wilder fight, of course, just a couple of months ago. But other than that, their schedule is pretty barren, has been barren, and looks pretty barren for the rest of 2019. What do you make of Showtime's 2019 to date and what they have kind of moving forward?
You know, a few months ago, I felt like I was the last person on the Showtime bandwagon just because 2019 has been so bad. And especially if you just look at the first half of 2018 was just so great. And one of the things they did really well that I appreciate then was they curated their content enormously well. Like, you knew all the undercards were fights that either were going to lead to something, or they were going to build to something, or they were significant fights in one way or another. And the main events were usually really well matched. I mean, they put on a great schedule, especially in that first half, and they just haven't done that. And it's weird. They front loaded most of their stuff last year. This year, it's just kind of been one show a month, and none of them have been that great. And I understand. I mean, look, they probably broke their pay scale in a major way to keep Deontay Wilder, to keep that fight in May on Showtime. if Wilder ends up fighting on Fox for pay-per-view, that's a really bad look. I don't even know what to make of that. And from what I've heard, that could be the case. You know, I know they haven't made an official announcement on it, but going back to that initial discussion with Fox, I mean, part of Fox, of what they're doing is making life easier and hopefully better financially for the PBC. And I'm sure that means that Showtime would have to step up in an unprecedented way on pay-per-view if they wanted to keep Wilder in the fold. So I don't know what to make of it. I mean, I would say, look, obviously it hasn't been great. The only thing that I can say for Showtime is they've had moments like this in the past and they've always rebounded. So, you know, whether that's just sort of taking some of that inventory and just quite frankly, making it better or owning a division, you know, in the future, maybe they have a good end of the year in 2019 and sort of take that momentum into 2020. But, you know, it hasn't felt great at all this year. That's, you know, and I don't think anyone can dispute that.
Do you think there's anything that could have been done? I mean, they announced their own deal with the PBC. I think it was before the Fox deal was announced, right before or right around the same time. But is there anything that could have been done to stop this sort of stampede towards with PBC fights going over to Fox?
It's a great question, and I think from my understanding of how the relationship works, they're so dependent on Al Heyman that they kind of had to let him get the first 6 months. You know, if he came and said to them, "Hey, look, I need the first 6 months. I need to put, you know, some of this stuff on Fox just to hit certain barriers or hit certain bonus levels in terms of audience growth or pay-per-view sales or anything like that," you know, I understand that. And look, a lot of fighters only fight twice a year, so maybe we've just seen the first round of great fights go to Fox, but it hasn't. A lot of the big names, they're on Fox, but and a lot of them are on Fox pay-per-view, and I don't see that trend reversing, especially on the pay-per-view side. So I think they need to rebuild, and I think the only thing I think they could have done to stop the flood is sort of maybe they could have gotten CBS involved on a higher level in terms of, you know, taking a fight to CBS here or there, or maybe using CBS to help market the fighters a little bit, you know, more prominently. But even look, they did that with Deontay Wilder. I mean, you saw him, you know, on CBS for some major sporting events. So it really strikes me as odd. I don't really understand it.
Yeah, you saw Deontay Wilder at the Final Four. I mean, that was something, I think 14 million people were watching at that time. So that's a huge boost for Wilder and for Showtime. And I agree with you. Unless CBS gets involved on a much higher level or any level, really, I don't see this is going to change much. As we look towards the fall, we know from, and I've talked to Stephen Espinosa about this on multiple occasions, he is not a big fan of doing major fights in the fall because he doesn't want to compete against college football. On the flip side of it, you've got Fox, which has NFL games in the fall where they can promote major fights, major pay-per-views. So I think 2019, I don't know how it's. I mean, we look back at 2013 as being a disaster, and they rebounded well from that. Showtime did, but I don't know how they bounce back from this with unless they get a flood of big fights in 2020 in the first half of it. I'm not sure how they bounce back exactly here. But I guess one way they could bounce back is if Fox is not enamored with some of the numbers it's doing on its network shows, on FS1, and maybe they don't want as many of those shows anymore. What's your take on the numbers that Fox has done in the first half of the year on their, not the pay-per-view numbers, but the network shows and the FS1 shows?
It's really a mixed bag. And I think one of the things, and I've actually talked about this a lot on my podcast, but when it comes to non-pay-per-view, well, first of all, even looking at pay-per-view, the Fox audience profiles as the likeliest audience to buy pay-per-views. That's one of the reasons I think Fox has pushed that so hard. It's typically an older demographic. I mean, I think there was a show actually in May where ESPN had a show on at, I believe, 10 o'clock Eastern, and Fox had the Herd J-Rock show on at 8 o'clock Eastern, and Top Rank had an Oscar Valdez show on. And it was like the perfect look at who watches each network, because if you just looked at the raw numbers, Fox did almost double the number of viewers that ESPN did. I think Fox was at like 1.7, 1.8 million, something like that, in terms of people who watched the show. You know, maybe it was a little bit less, but ESPN was right around, you know, 750,000, 800,000 viewers. But when you actually broke it down and you looked at the audience that really matters to advertisers, 18 to 49, it was really close. And we actually looked at it 18 to 34, which obviously is, you know, younger audience, which matters, you know, less in terms of premium prices to advertisers, but more in terms of what's coming next. I think actually ESPN did more viewers than Fox did in that demo, despite having almost half the number of total viewers. And it just makes it very clear. I mean, that's why ESPN, you know, even though some of their numbers haven't been great, it's a great platform because so many young people watch it. And network TV, you know, it's basically, network TV is facing this challenge with traditional comedies and dramas where just less and less people are watching them overall. And way less people in the demos that matter to advertisers are watching them, and they're freaking out. They don't know what to do. So, I mean, in one respect, that's not good for Fox. When you look at the numbers like that, in another respect, you could probably look at it and say, well, they're doing so poorly with their comedies and dramas, especially with how cheap they're getting boxing for, that's a real breath of fresh air. Like you can look at that and say, hey, this could be the future. And I think that is part of the way Fox is looking at it. I mean, I was talking to people, you know, just to give a little context, like I was talking to people, you know, I have a lot of friends who work in the non-sports entertainment industry out here. To do a good quality hour-long drama costs about $4.4 million an episode for a place like Fox. And Fox is probably paying less to get 2.5 or 3 hours, you know, out of one night of fights. And in some cases, not even doing that worse on the ratings. You know, they're definitely, compared to the bigger shows, they're doing significantly worse. Like, there's no question about that. But for the shows that aren't doing that well, like the hour-long dramas that aren't doing that well, some of the better PBC shows actually come close to hitting those numbers, basically. So, it you know, again, it's like this weird mixed bag of what do you do? Like, no, the numbers aren't great overall, but the landscape is changing so much that, you know, maybe they're not as bad as you think.
If you had to, I mean, it's all guesswork at this point, but if you had to kind of project over the next couple of years of this Fox deal, is it sustainable to continue to put shows? I mean, will a network like Fox want to continue to put shows on as consistently as they have? And again, I know it's just sort of projecting and guessing, but what do you think? Is this something that's going to be sustainable for them?
I think if they can work it into that overall strategy, because remember, we haven't, some of those numbers, like remember, and we talked about this earlier this year, the Caleb Plant show, which got all that NFL promotion, that right. Did like almost 1 million viewers at peak. It was, you know, well over, it was like 750,000 average audience. Every other FS1 show is at like 220, 230, 250. So when they're using their big properties to promote it correctly, I mean, just think if they did Spence Porter and they used the NFL to promote that on regular Fox instead of pay-per-view, you could really see what kind of an audience boxing could draw there. I mean, there's huge potential there. And if boxing can sort of, if they can do that and really grab some of those bigger audiences, I think it's definitely sustainable. And we haven't seen it. You remember also, the NFL is on Sundays. Well, WWE is going to be on Friday night and boxing's on Saturday night. I mean, that, you know, you think there's a lot of room for audience crossover there too. And they haven't even had that come up yet. So that's another great promotional tool for them to use. So if they do a lot of those things, I think they can make it work. And I think the network is trending that they're becoming a lot more focused on live entertainment, on sports, and that's got to be the plan. And they pay a lot more for all these other things. And so if they promote it correctly, they can look at boxing and say, hey, this is really cheap programming that we're getting adequate ratings out of, especially when we promote it correctly, and it could be a real profit center. But I would love
to see them try that with Spence Porter, where that's like, what, week 3 or 4 of the NFL season, a lot of interest around that time. Use the NFL as a promotional vehicle to drive people to that fight. use the WWE, like you said. I didn't even think of that, but the WWE is a huge audience.
Yep.
Use that to promote a fight and just see what kind of number that you could do. Like, take a chance, roll the dice. Maybe you do, like, what was that number that Spence did after the Olympic game? That was a huge number he did after the gold medal game. It was on NBC.
It was like 6 or 7 or 8. I mean, it was something crazy. Like, and that wasn't even in really a marquee matchup at all. I mean,
oh, it was a terrible fight.
And basically with no promotion, it just kind of like popped on right after the basketball game. But no, I remember
I was in Rio, like I'm sitting there watching the game. We were doing post game for it. I'm sitting there watching the gold medal game come to an end. And right after it ended, like, I don't even know. They did the ceremony, maybe. I don't know what happened, but it was like immediately after it ended, they went straight into the ring, and Spence is standing there. Like, he was in the corner. Like, they were ready to go with that fight. I remember thinking, like, wow, that has to be the best lead-up a fight's ever gotten, or best build-up a fight's ever gotten.
Yeah, and they didn't mess around with undercards. They just went straight to the main event. I mean, it's great. It's like, so if they do all that stuff, and you know, the potential is huge and the cost is so low. I mean, and that's what it comes down to. You always wonder, like, is the cost low because it's a dart throw, or is the cost low because this is a property that once they get a little bit more information on, they can get behind it, and then really it can become a profit center, you know, especially considering how much they pay for everything else.
Yeah, man, I really they're not going to do it. It's probably going to wind up on pay-per-view, but man, that'd be a fun experiment to see.
Well, and that's the frustrating part, because yeah, it is probably going to end up on pay-per-view. You know, they basically said as much, and you know, we probably won't see this. And look, if it trends the other way, and Fox becomes, you know, if boxing for Fox is the lowest thing on the totem pole, and no one really cares that much about it because they're spending so little money on it, then it's going to go the other way, and it's just going to sort of, you know, pitter out, and you know, that's going to be that. Maybe they won't renew it.
And think about what that would do for Spence and Porter and their brand in general. Like, you go from, you know, what, let's say 200,000 that watched their fight versus like 5 million potentially that would watch their fight. Like, if the football stuff or the WWE stuff does its job. I know we use exposure, we talk about it as like this greatest thing in the world, but that's a big thing to get that many eyeballs on you in a significant fight like that. Which I think is going to be a good fight, because I mean, everybody that fights Sean Porter looks like they're in a car accident afterwards, but it's a good, significant fight that would do a huge number and expose them to an audience that may never, has never seen them before.
Yeah. I mean, with Sean Porter too, it's a good point, because if, you know, We've seen him before. If we're seeing the aggressive Sean Porter, it's going to be a fun TV fight, and there'll be lots of action. And I think casuals will probably enjoy that no matter what, especially if he's just going to be coming forward. You know, if we see maybe the version of him that fought Ugas, maybe not quite as much, but I agree. I mean, I think it's a chance to build a huge audience. I think it's a chance to really show top level talent fighting to a lot of different people. I mean, those are the moments where you make a lot of fans. Like, it's not where you come right after the Olympic game and just sort of jump in the ring and don't set it up. You don't have a sort of a clip explaining why this is significant and who Errol Spence is. You know, that I almost looked at as like a little bit of a wasted opportunity, because you didn't even have a little marketing piece saying like why this fight is significant. With Spence and Porter, I mean, you can do a whole build up and you can make, there can be a huge awareness of not only why this is a big fight, but who Errol Spence is, who Sean Porter is. You can really build their individual brands with it.
Yeah. Two American fighters, you know, well-spoken. I think they'd help the promotion. I mean, it's too logical for it to actually get done. So it's boxing. We'll go back to pay-per-view and 200,000 buys, and that's it. All right, let's talk about DAZN and Golden Boy and all the drama that's going on with Canelo Alvarez at this point. Evan, as we record this at around 6:30 on Thursday night, we don't have any resolution to what Canelo Alvarez is going to do next. He is in the midst of negotiations with Sergey Derevyanchenko, the IBF mandatory. DAZN has elected to approve Derevyanchenko as an opponent for Canelo after spending weeks, if not months, saying he was not an option for them, and spending at least the last few weeks saying he was only an option if Canelo agreed to fight Gennady Golovkin sometime next year. That apparently is off the table now. They want a Canelo fight and are willing to do
this particular fight. All that being said, there isn't a deal at this point between Golden Boy and Lou DiBella and Al Haymon and Keith Conley and the 17 people that Derevyanchenko have working for him at this point. So there's a real strong possibility as we record this that they don't get a deal in time for tomorrow. But let's start here with the DAZN aspect of it. What do you make of the fact that DAZN has elected to allow Canelo to fight effectively who he wants without a guarantee of Golovkin next year?
This is craziness. And this is just craziness on all parties, specifically with DAZN. It's like, why even play this high-stakes game of poker? Why even go through the motions of having an approved opponent list if you're just going to let Canelo do whatever he wants anyways? I don't know if it's a breakdown of communication. Sounds like there's several breakdowns in communication here, but it's really optically a terrible look for them. And to have this whole drama play out publicly is just it's really weird. Now, I don't know that specifically could be blamed on DAZN, but you know, it sounds like they built in some actual leverage into the contract, and then none of it, when it actually gets tested, nothing's, you know, they're not having any leverage. Legally they may have some, but obviously in the HBO Showtime world of pay-per-views, if a pay-per-view never happened, or if it happened against a lesser opponent, HBO or Showtime just makes a little bit less money, and you roll on and you try to get the bigger fight next year. DAZN needs Canelo, and it's painfully obvious that they need him to fight, and it doesn't matter against who.
Yeah, it is one thing to have leverage. It's another thing to want to use it if using it means you don't get your flagship fighter fighting on your platform that year. And Canelo Alvarez means subscriptions. Canelo Alvarez means protecting against the churn rate of those subscriptions. He is the driving force behind boxing subscriptions at DAZN. So it is, I guess they decided, and I can't blame them necessarily, but they decided that having him on their platform was better than not having him on their platform in 2019 or the rest of 2019. Regardless of who he fights at this point. My bigger gripe at this point, Evan, though, is with Golden Boy and their inability and laughable inability to deliver on some of the promises that they made, on some of the big fights that they promised to deliver. I mean, everyone inside the DAZN walls, they expected that come September 14th, we would see Canelo versus Golovkin. Golden Boy told them that they could deliver Canelo versus Golovkin. They could not. Now, there clearly was some kind of miscommunication there. Maybe Golden Boy believed that Canelo would be willing to fight Gennady Golovkin. Maybe they believed that it wasn't going to be this big a deal, that maybe some more money could grease the skids. But for whatever reason, Canelo Alvarez is not willing to fight Golovkin. That's number one. Number two, you have Sergey Kovalev out there. The Kovalev situation, where I thought Golden Boy mishandled that enormously, where if they had come to the table with the final offer that they had about a week or so ago, we would have a deal for Canelo to fight Kovalev. Instead, they waited too long. They let Kovalev sign that deal to fight over in Russia, and then main events and Kovalev simply couldn't untangle it. So that was another problem. And even this Derevyanchenko stuff. Now, again, I hope this podcast, when it comes out Friday morning, we don't seem dated here, but from what I understand, there was a point in the last week or so that if they came up to the dollar figure they're at right now, a deal would have been done, that it would have been settled on. So I'm hearing a lot of this information, you know, second and third hand, but it just seems like Golden Boy could have done a lot more to make these fights. And as a partner of DAZN and somebody that you would think would want to see DAZN stay in business for as long as possible, you would think they'd be better at making these types of deals.
You've done a great job outlining it, and I think what's really mind blowing here is you go back, and some of this is just the disappointment of what DAZN's dealing with, because it's like what you said. You would have thought coming out of that Anthony Joshua and Andrew Ruiz fight, DAZN has this incredible opportunity to build up their subscription base with a Canelo Triple G 3 fight in September, and then in either November or December, an Anthony Joshua, Andy Ruiz rematch in the U.S. That gives you two primetime U.S. fights to build your subscription base Like, the world is your oyster if you're DAZN. They may not get either of those. I mean, they may get the Anthony Joshua, Andy Ruiz fight in the UK. It sounds like they're going to get that one way or the other. But then come back to Canelo. I mean, if you're from the Golden Boy perspective, you go from, look, at the start of John Skipper's regime, he brings in specifically Golden Boy. He kind of hands them the keys to the kingdom. They deliver a Canelo-Danny Jacobs fight, which is easily the top subscription-driving day. You know, that fight is easily the top subscription driver for DAZN. It's easily the top subscription-driving day, that the day of that fight. They're now in pole position, and now it's such, like, just a – I mean, it's the biggest gigantic mess. It's exactly what you described. So many different scenarios that where it's just egg on their face, and – you're wondering, like, if you're John Skipper, you have to be wondering, like, what did I do here? Like, these guys, I've given them so many opportunities, and I don't know whether it's miscommunications, I don't know what it is, but it's really, they're not delivering. Eddie Hearn is actually now the guy delivering for DAZN, not Golden Boy. So it's like, if you're Golden Boy, you're kind of losing that position as the top provider for DAZN. And I don't know the specifics of their deals, but I mean, the company is kept afloat by the deal that they made, and you just outlined every single one of these probably could have been done under the right scenario, or at least communicated better. Instead, you have all this drama playing out in public, all of it making DAZN looking incredibly foolish if you're a hardcore boxing fan. There's so many different ways this could have gone better for all parties, but especially with the way that it was handled out in the public and not really delivering anything of significant value. Now, I think at the end of the day, despite all the optics, you might be right. All DAZN might need is just a Canelo fight in the fall. Especially when you consider that DirecTV package that has kind of been dangling out there, it might just go back for NFL Sunday Ticket. It might go specifically back to DirecTV this year, and that window of negotiation where DAZN could have been a major player for that. Maybe now that's not as big of a deal if that's just going to revert back to DirecTV. That was one of the things. Talk about a great pitch to the NFL. It's like, hey, we got these two big fights coming up in the fall, or our subscription base is going to explode, especially when you bring this to the table. Maybe now that's not the biggest opportunity missed, and they just have Canelo fight anybody, and you try to retain as much of the subscriptions you've already built and reduce the churn, and maybe you don't, build a bunch of new subscribers until you obviously place a lot of value on the Anthony Joshua Ruiz rematch. But look, it's just a huge missed opportunity in so many areas.
Is it, to look at Canelo for a quick minute here, is it strange to you? I mean, how would you describe what you're seeing with Canelo and Golovkin, and specifically how Canelo feels about not fighting Golovkin? Because you have Canelo out there, and he would make the very most money to fight Gennady Golovkin. He wouldn't have to deal with all the drama of a negotiation, because those numbers are pretty much set in rock. Like, they're done. Like, who's going to make and what. That would have been an incredibly easy negotiation. You turn it around, and Mike Coppinger tweeted this out, and I know for a fact that he's right, that Canelo was willing to shave off some of his own money to fight Derevyanchenko. Like, he's willing to give back money for a fight that, yeah, it's probably an easier fight, but I'd still think he's a favorite against Gennady Golovkin. He's willing to give back money rather than fight Gennady Golovkin. What do you make of that?
I mean, it makes you, if I'm DAZN, I interpret that as I would have pessimism that the fight ever happens at all. And in that case, why did you invest $100 million in Gennady Golovkin if you weren't going to get the Canelo Golovkin 3 fight? I've never really heard of, I mean, I think, like, maybe there's a couple instances in the NBA where there's buyouts where players give up some money to chase championships, but, like, I've really never heard of it ever happening in pro sports. I mean, it's boxing and nothing surprises me, and fighters make strange emotional financial decisions all the time. And maybe this is just Canelo really sticking it to Golovkin. I mean, it's what it sounds like is happening here, and really trying to show him who's boss. And maybe he does want to fight him eventually a little bit later, but this is a real head scratcher. Like, I would never, if I was a manager or a lawyer for a fighter, I would never advise a fighter to give up money in any situation if you've signed a guaranteed contract like that.
I just want to know what triggered Canelo. Was it something that Golovkin said? Was it something that Abel Sanchez said? Is it something that happened in the second fight that maybe he doesn't want to experience again? Because the optics of this, they suggest that Canelo would go into that fight as a decent favorite. He wouldn't. I mean, Golovkin, I don't look at what he did against Steve Rolls as being a surefire indicator of what he is right now. But Golovkin has shown time and again that he's able to get hit. He's 37 years old. I mean, I don't really understand it. There has to be something at the root of all this. That's why whenever this deal is announced, I want to be first in line to interview Canelo and ask him what in the hell is going on right now. Like, what is happening that's caused you to turn away from Golovkin and look to basically anybody but Golovkin, whether it's Kovalev, Derevchenko, Munguia, outside of Demetrius Andrade, who, by the way, was trying to work his way into the mix in the last week or so. Eddie Hearn was pitching him hard as an opponent for Canelo.
He should be.
But that was never going to happen.
He should be trying to work himself in the mix. And here's the other thing.
Yeah, no, go ahead. I agree with you.
He should be trying to work himself in the mix. And here's the other thing. It sounded not too long ago like we were ready to have Canelo Triple G 3, and the major, you know, bone of contention was whether the fight was going to be in Vegas or not. And it, like, how did we get from there to the point where, you know, and I know that's somewhat of a big deal, especially on the Golovkin side, but how did we get from that point to all of a sudden the point where it's like, Canelo's giving up money to really avoid fighting Golovkin, and it's not clearly that he fears him. It's he's trying to prove a point here. So I have no idea how we got to that point. I mean, that's either a breakdown in communication between the Canelo and Golden Boy side. Like, maybe Canelo's just trying to show everybody he's boss. That he rules the sport. He's, you know, the boss of Golden Boy. He's the boss of the zone. I don't know. I mean, like, it's. You know, fighters love to exercise their leverage, but this is certainly an extreme version of it that I've really never seen before.
I feel like the Vegas thing was always something of a red herring. I feel like all along that Canelo didn't want to fight Golovkin. Golden Boy knew it, but they didn't want to admit to it at that point. I just don't know. I mean, look, you get through 2019, fine. Canelo versus whomever, Golovkin versus whomever. You get Ruiz Joshua, which is, you know, the big fight they didn't expect. And look, I'm wondering too, Evan. You know, Eddie Hearn, during an interview on the broadcast with me last weekend, you know, kind of slipped in that, you know, when they announced Joshua Ruiz, the rematch, we'll be surprised by what they announced for the venue. I don't know what that means, but maybe it does mean it's not earmarked for Cardiff. So they're getting a big fight at the end of the year they didn't expect. But I'm with you on the idea that they've got to figure this Canelo Golovkin stuff out. Does he never want to fight Gennady Golovkin? If so, some decisions probably need to be made. Or is it just a matter of you'll wait till May, maybe September of 2020 at the latest, and then give him another shot? But I would think that's got to be a top priority over at DAZN right now.
Well, yeah, and you have to wonder if there's really this much animosity. You know, the way approved opponent lists work, basically it sounded like this time it played out where there were two approved opponents, and that's pretty small traditionally. Like, usually, like from the HBO days, like there's usually a pretty significant list of approved opponents. And you have to wonder if you're DAZN, like, are we ever going to be in a scenario where we give Golden Boy one approved opponent for Canelo? Like, is that the only way to make this fight? Like, is it, like, clearly money, usually money is a really motivating factor. It may not be the motivating factor here. I mean, there must be such crazy animosity, you know, or there's just so, you know, the information that's being given, there's miscommunications and misinformation to the point that we're, you know, no one really knows the answer. And I don't know, but it's so crazy to me that we would see it play out like this, and we would see it play out in public like this. I, you know, it's just, you wouldn't ever expect anything like this.
When the dust settles, we'll need to do a thorough autopsy of everything that happened in all this, beginning with hearing it from Canelo directly. Evan, always appreciate your time, man. Terrific stuff, top to bottom. Thanks for joining me, man.
All right, thanks.